today on Against the Grain. A radical intellectual, she participated in a great variety of social movements and political groupings, among them the New Left, the IRA, and the Communist Party of Ireland. I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Helena Sheehan about a book that's part memoir, part political, social, and intellectual history, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. My, what Helena Sheehan has seen and experienced. The Cold War, the 60s, Northern Ireland, European socialism and communism, visits to the USSR. Sheehan's life intersected with a dizzying array of radical movements and political conjunctures, and she did more than take part in them. As an academic, as a radical philosopher, she also thought and wrote about the key ideas of and key debates within socialism and communism. All this from someone who grew up in the stifling conformism of the 1950s and became, for a time, a Catholic nun. Helena Sheehan is professor emerita at Dublin City University, and she's the author of, among other books, Marxism and the Philosophy of Science, A Critical History. Her new book describes her life, her ideas, and the at times turbulent world around her, from 1944, the year of her birth, to 1988. It's called Navigating the Zeitgeist, a story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism. When Helena Sheehan joined me recently from Ireland, I noted that in the introduction to her book, she writes that she's striving for something more than memoir. What, I asked, is that something more?
Well, I wanted to write a work of intellectual, political, social history. I wanted to write about the movements of my time, but to do it in a vivid and intimate way through my own life experience. Because I'm a Marxist, or maybe because I believe in focusing on forces of history, I am a Marxist. And so there's a bit of reticence about the idea of a memoir. Because we tend to be more focused on forces of history rather than personalities. But I think that we experience forces of history through living a life. And I believe that it's a more vivid, intimate way of talking about social, political, intellectual movements to do it through the flow of experience. Because after all, that's from where the history has come. It comes from people living lives and conceptualizing the universe. And I wanted to write intellectual, political, social history in that way.
You were born in July 1944 in Philadelphia. How Catholic was your upbringing?
My upbringing was very, very, very Catholic. My parents, grandparents were Catholic. My schools were Catholic. My books were Catholic. My mentors were Catholic. The whole subculture in which I grew up was Catholic. On top of that, I was particularly Catholic. I was very fervent. I was very obsessed, even as a child, about seeing the whole, some kind of idea of totality. I didn't have the word then, but I always had the big picture. And not got caught up in the trivial details of everyday life, which I saw people around me doing. And Catholicism really answered that need for a full-blooded worldview. And also a worldview that demanded all of yourself. So I was very, very Catholic.
So then perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that you decided to enter a convent?
No, it was very natural. I mean, I was conflicted. I was fascinated by politics. I had got my first job before I entered, and I had that bit of freedom from having graduated from high school and working in a detective agency and moving around the city center of Philadelphia. And I felt the pull to going to university and doing something else. But I really felt called. This whole sense of believing in something and giving yourself to it totally demanded of me that I enter the convent, yes.
Now, you did gravitate toward philosophy at a pretty early age. You write that by the time you were in high school, you started reading works of philosophy. The skepticism that comes with philosophy, did that affect the way that you experienced Catholicism? Did that affect your time in the convent and how you assessed and evaluated your experiences there?
Very much so. I had very serious doubts. I struggled with them very intensely. I asked myself, why did I believe in God? Just because my parents and grandparents and teachers all believed in God? Is that reason enough? I went through the whole five proofs of the existence of God. I pondered all the ontological and cosmological arguments, and I struggled to believe. And I managed to continue to believe in that way. In the convent, the whole way of life raised further questions, which I've dealt with in a lot of detail in the book. My, you know, what everyday life was like, and my inner struggles. This, the whole monastic ethos of the convent raised another whole level of questioning, and I struggled with it all along, and that's ultimately what made me leave. I left the convent, and then not that long after, I left the church. But it was philosophical questioning that drove me out.
By losing your faith, I think you might be referring to a point where you were teaching sixth grade in Brookhaven, Pennsylvania, and then you were fired. Why were you fired from that position, and why do you write that you lost your job, your faith, and your home that day?
Yes, that was the worst day of my life. I was teaching fifth grade as a nun at Corpus Christi School in inner city Philadelphia. When I left the convent, I applied for a job to teach sixth grade in Brookhaven, Pennsylvania. It was a bit of a battle for me to even get that job, because at that time, you know, hiring an ex-nun was not something that would have been done. And I also battled to be able to teach religion. In those days, even if there was a lay teacher, you would have to leave the room while a nun taught religion. So I said, if I was qualified to teach it last year, I'm qualified to teach it this year. So I had battled, first of all, to get the job because I was an ex-nun, and then to teach religion. So I was all fired up about Vatican II, and I was all fired up about the civil rights movement in the South. And I taught the children Vatican II theology instead of having them just, you know, rotely memorizing questions and answers from the catechism, which is how religion was taught in the school at that time. And also in civics classes, I taught them about the civil rights movement, and I taught them how to sing We Shall Overcome. I was a mild liberal, that's all. And I didn't realize it. But the other teachers and parents were organizing against me. And one day in the afternoon, right in the middle of a history class, the principal, who was also the superior, pulled me out of class, said, "Miss Sheehan, you're wanted in the superintendent's office." So I went into the superintendent's office, and he fired me. And he said he very much regretted it, but I was before my time and it had to be done. There was too much discontent, and, you know, the parents and teachers, other teachers and pupils weren't ready for this yet. So I went out. I was quite shocked by this. I was unemployed. I walked out, and all of my doubts about the very existence of God, which I had been fighting off and managing to continue to believe, all of my doubts just came to a crescendo. I tried to pray because I was, you know, shocked and upset. I tried to pray, and I just had this sudden sense that there was no one there to hear it. And I felt my whole worldview crumble. I felt as if the ground would come from under my feet. And to top it all off, it was thunder and lightning and pouring rain, which, you know, it does affect your mood, you know. Mm-hmm. It does. It makes every bad thing worse. And I just had collapsed. I went home and I told my parents, and they said they were ashamed of me. And why did I always have to rock the boat? I put everything that I had into a suitcase and I walked out, and I lived for several weeks, bus stations and train stations, and all of that. And I was really quite desperate. But it was the loss of my worldview, as well as the loss of my job and my home, coming all at once. that made me about as alone and as desperate as I think I've ever been.
Her name is Helena Sheehan. She is Professor Emerita at Dublin City University. We are talking about her memoir. It's called Navigating the Zeitgeist, a story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I imagine what you then, well, I know, since I've read your book, that at that point, one of your priorities was to search for a new worldview while learning to live without God. What was that process like, and what kinds of avenues did you pursue in that quest?
Well, learning to live in a world without God was very difficult, because for Catholicism, just everything, the meaning of life, morality, everything was bound up with the existence of God. So, you know, I was in free fall, and I had to learn how to build again, almost from scratch. So I ran to philosophy. I got very, very into existentialist texts. Camus' book, The Myth of Sisyphus, meant a lot to me at the time. The whole idea of, you know, rolling the rock up the hill. And basically, it was about finding the meaning of life in life itself and not in anything outside. And basically extending that, you know, to explain the world in terms of the world itself and not in terms of any supernatural forces. So existentialist texts meant quite a lot to me. And I also got into American pragmatism and naturalism. John Dewey, I felt, was very astute in the whole working out a naturalistic, contextualist process of worldview. And so that's where I was philosophically. People have this caricature about people who go from Catholicism to Marxism, and Marxism is just another religion. But I didn't find it like that at all. There was a whole decade between leaving Catholicism and going to Marxism. And I had a lot of the elements from Marxism already in place without calling it Marxism. At the same time, I was active on the left. And so, you know, one thing led to another. But I don't think you can lose a world and then take another worldview off the shelf. I had to painfully reconstruct a worldview for myself, and it didn't come that quickly or that easily.
This was the 60s, and to what extent did the crisis you experienced in your worldview jibe with crises that you saw all around you in terms of protest and activism and just questioning of the status quo, whether politically or culturally?
Oh, well, very much it resonated with that. Not in the very beginning. I felt very alone with it because, you know, I'd been cloistered for 3 years and nobody around me in my immediate subculture was going through anything remotely like what I was going through. So I didn't experience that immediately. When I left in 1965. But I gradually became aware of SDS and, you know, the New Left and all these things that had been happening while I was in the cloister. And one day I was watching television. It was a television interview with Tom Hayden. And he was basically articulating the ideas that were in the Port Huron statement. And I just said, you know how somebody says something and it's what you were just about to think. You're just on the edge of thinking. Mm-hmm. So it had a really powerful effect on me. So Tom Hayden was a very important voice in my world at that particular moment. And so I opened myself, you know, more to the civil rights movement, to the anti-war movement, to the New Left, and to the whole atmosphere in universities at the time. Where I was going to night school, I was desperate to get a degree, of course, but I had to work full time during the day. And I got more and more into university life. I went to graduate school after 2 years of that. And, you know, I was very much then, by the late 60s, part of this whole atmosphere on U.S. university campuses where everything was called into question. Just nothing that had been received could be taken on faith. Everything had to be scrutinized. Everything had to be rethought. And so what I was going through then very much resonated with the whole atmosphere of the time. In fact, there couldn't have been a better time for somebody to have this kind of crisis of faith.
So then I take it that politics for you and your associates and your fellow activists was not then just about seizing control of state power and economic power. It was about something much more holistic. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. It was about everything. It was about everything. It was about the texture of everyday life as much as it was the commanding heights of, you know, production, distribution and exchange. It was about everything. It was a very holistic, fluid way of talking about politics and experiencing politics.
And I think at this point you were more inclined toward anarchism. Was anarchism in the air? And am I correct in remembering that you were kind of more skeptical of Marxism at the time?
Yes, that's correct. I'd grown up with Cold War anti-communism, and I still had a residue of that when I first came to the left. Just because I was left didn't mean that, you know, I was a communist. I had a very new left attitude to the old left, partly a generational thing, that, you know, a generation comes on the scene and they think they're going to recreate the whole world and nobody else got it right before them. When I got older, I experienced this from younger activists. but I was like this as a younger activist myself. I had a lot of the new left caricatures of the old left, which took me some time to work my way through. So we thought we knew everything better, but we didn't necessarily. We did bring new insights into American left traditions. This is true. It was a much more holistic idea of what it meant to be left, and we were much more into culture and everyday life. But they understood a lot of things that we didn't understand at the time. And so I had to work my way through that. And yes, I was more inclined to anarchism than to Marxism. At first, it was just a rough and ready experiential anarchism, but I then began to study anarchist texts, and I was quite impressed with Goldman and Kropotkin and Bakunin and some more contemporary anarchist thinkers of my own generation, Mary Butchkin, and in Philadelphia we had this area, Powhatan Village, which was a kind of new left enclave, and we were having a debate about Marxism versus anarchism, and I was firmly on the anarchist side of it, and I never imagined that I would become a Marxist not that long after.
And speaking of trying to, you know, think about and build alternative institutions and to think about transforming everyday interactions and relationships, marriage is obviously a fairly conventional thing to do. You did marry a man named Jack in 1967. How did you feel about marriage at that time?
Very ambivalent. I'm still very ambivalent. On balance, I don't believe in marriage even now. But, you know, it was a good relationship, and I hadn't my full critique of marriage worked out in 1967. And he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. And he was a fellow activist. He was a university lecturer, and he was a fellow activist. We were comrades. And it was a very fine relationship, but it didn't turn out to be a marriage.
In what sense?
I wasn't monogamous after a brief period of time. I was just part of that whole atmosphere of the 1960s, and I found people around me too coupley. I just didn't want that kind of relationship. And it was a very harmonious relationship. He was a very fine person, and we actually got on very well. But I just couldn't fit into marriage.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Helena Sheehan joins me. She is author of a number of books, including Marxism and the Philosophy of Science, A Critical History, and Irish Television Drama, A Society and Its Stories. We are talking about her newly issued memoir, which covers her life up till 1988, It is called Navigating the Zeitgeist, a story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism, and it's published by Monthly Review Press. So I'm just reading here from your book. This is the time that you were caught up in all this activism and trying also to do your academic work, your PhD. The texture of our everyday lives was transformed by a vibrant counterculture of communes, co-ops, collectives, speak-outs, sit-ins, teach-ins, be-ins, die-ins, vigils, consciousness-raising, street theater, underground press, and independent cinema. I mean, the energy that just emerges from that list of activities and engagements is very strong. I mean, it must have been a very heady time for you, a feeling like perhaps revolution was around the corner?
Yes, it felt like that. Looking back, it seems very naive, when you were in the middle of it, it felt exactly like that. There was this enormous network all over the country and beyond the country in the world of people experimenting with new ways of life. And it was very vibrant. It felt very powerful. We didn't have a strong enough sense of political economy. We didn't really understand, you know, how we didn't understand how powerful the system itself was. There were just so many of us, and we were, you know, just so full of everything that we were doing and creating that we felt we were more powerful than we were. And it felt like a revolution was very possible. But of course it wasn't.
You reacted strongly against certain things that you saw going on within the activist groups you were a part of. One was a drive for self-purification. Tell us about that.
Well, I was part of that myself. This whole atmosphere of rethinking everything and this revulsion of the whole culture in which we'd grown up. And the whole idea of the new man and the new society. We were very hard on ourselves. We felt we had to achieve something enormous, both in remaking ourselves and remaking the society. And of course, we had many failures. And I always had personally perfectionist tendencies. And you have to come to terms with the fact that you're not perfect. So it was individually and culturally a big problem. But I was part of the problem.
And what about perceptions of women within the movement? To what degree was sexism within these groupings a problem in your eyes?
Well, in the early days of the New Left, that wasn't very articulated. And by the late 60s, it was being articulated in the left and also beyond the left. The whole second wave feminism had a profound effect on me. And I grew up with very traditionalist ideas of what a female was. And it never felt right to me, never. I always, you know, I kind of wanted to be male, not because of being trans or anything like that, but everybody who was doing anything consequential in the world, anyone I respected was male. And so it was very difficult to get over that. And then there was this atmosphere in the late 60s with second wave feminism, where it redefined what was masculine and what was feminine. And I learned, you know, not to concede. And it never felt right to concede that rationality was male, that activity in the public world was the male domain. That never felt right to me. And now there was this whole movement affirming that and giving me a whole way of conceptualizing what just felt wrong to me. And so it was a tremendous relief to redefine all these things. And so it was going on in the left, a lot of, you know, when you name any of the best known leaders of the New Left, they were all male. Most of them were male. And so the females within the New Left started to question that and to demand that a division of labor within the left itself. And it happened. You know, it was very fraught at times, but it happened.
There were several strands of feminism, liberal feminism, socialist feminism, radical feminism. What was the difference between socialist feminism and radical feminism, and why did you identify as a socialist feminist?
Radical feminism, first of all, liberal feminism just wanted, you know, equal rights, equal pay, more or less within the system itself. Radical feminism was a more thoroughgoing critique. It questioned the system of patriarchy, but it saw patriarchy as in and of itself the problem. Patriarchy is a whole worldview, and patriarchy as the core thing that had to be confronted. I never saw it that way. I saw patriarchy as part of the system, but not the whole system itself. And to me, it became more and more the whole global system, which I came to, you know, identify as capitalism, imperialism, and patriarchy was within that. But I never, I was not into a separatist form of feminism. I felt it was part of a wider struggle for liberation, and gender was only one issue alongside class and race and other issues. And I couldn't devote myself entirely to feminism, excluding these other struggles.
Helena Sheehan, Professor Emerita at Dublin City University. We'll take a short break and speak more with her about her new book, Navigating the Zeitgeist. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Helena Sheehan joins me. She is a longtime activist and teacher, educator. She taught history of ideas and media studies and a lot of other things at Dublin City University. And her new book is Navigating the Zeitgeist, a story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism. It was in Ireland, and I want to ask you about that in a moment, but it was in Ireland that you leaned more and more toward Marxism and then became a Marxist. I mean, I think you already kind of began to answer this question, but what prompted your full-hearted turn toward Marxism and, you know, away from some of the other radical theories, theoretical foundations that you had engaged with?
Well, coming to Europe from America was a very interesting experience on many levels and in many respects. One of the things that I found interesting was less marginalized, was more part of the texture of the society. There wasn't such a gap between these left enclaves and mainstream society. I found that kind of interesting. But I joined the Republican movement. There was Sinn Féin and the IRA. They had split before I arrived between right and left, and I joined the left called the Official Sinn Féin, Official IRA. And the movement at that time was having this debate about Marxism. It was in the process of becoming Marxist, but there were still, you know, anarchist movementist tendencies there. Although most of the people resisting Marxism were the ones who went to the right. But because people chose not to put all of the emphasis on armed struggle and to look at the movement as a national liberation movement alongside other international liberation movements, didn't mean that they went immediately to Marxism. But the leading figures in Sinn Féin and IRA were Marxist at that time. And so I immediately became caught up in the debate there about Marxism. And for the first time, seriously reading Marxist texts, going to lectures on it and then giving lectures on it. And within my first year in Ireland, I became a Marxist, and I was very much part of the debate within that organization on the other side.
To what extent did Marxism help you understand kind of the whole thing, to put the pieces together in a way that made sense to you. And I'm talking about kind of, you know, all the economic facts and political tendencies and cultural sensibilities that you saw around you.
That's exactly the effect that it had. It's like a puzzle, and I had a lot of the pieces of the puzzle in place. But when I became a Marxist, I kind of saw the pattern. I saw how it all fit together in a way that I hadn't quite before, in a way I was striving for, but hadn't achieved. And the whole level of political economy and science were kind of weak in my worldview when I was a New Leftist. And when I became a Marxist, these dimensions entered into it. And then that illuminated all the other dimensions. And I felt, yes, this is how it all fits together. It was like something clicked. And it had a whole full-blooded philosophy of history, as well as the foundations in political economy. And it just had the holistic texture and grounding that I needed.
You joined Sinn Féin in 1972, the year you moved to Ireland, and you were involved in political education there. You promoted feminism. You joined the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, a few months later. There's a lot to be said about this part of your life, and you know, we're going to skip around a little bit just in interest of time, but you did resign from Sinn Féin in 1975. There was bitter factionalism and infighting. And then you joined the Communist Party of Ireland. So can you talk a little bit about what made you gravitate toward the CPI?
Yeah, well, there's a lot in the book about all the different factions and splits. I won't go on about that. And that was part of why I left. But the main reason why I left Sinn Féin and joined the CPI was that with this intense study of Marxism, it was also a study of the history of the communist movement. And I felt I had become a communist. And why not join the Communist Party?
And what did you find when you joined the Communist Party in terms of its stance in relation to communist movements, different communist movements, and the Soviet model?
Well, I'd already, when I was in Sinn Féin, become more and more pro-Soviet. I became quite interested in the Soviet Union. And when I joined the CPI, that kind of opened up a different relationship with the Soviet Union and with the other socialist countries of Eastern Europe. Because we were, you know, we had a direct relationship with those parties that were in power at the time. And that was kind of heady. And I went twice to study at the International Lenin School in Moscow. You know, to somebody that grew up in the 1950s in America during the Cold War, with this whole idea of the Iron Curtain. And then I crossed over to the other side. And, you know, to walk the streets of Moscow and to stand there in Red Square in the Kremlin and realize that this, you know, this was who I was now. You know, it was very exhilarating and challenging. And I spent a lot of time in the other countries of Eastern Europe. I developed a whole network of relationships with the Marxist intelligentsia of those countries. I did it partly as an activist in the Communist Party, but also as somebody who was writing a book about Marxism. These two dimensions flowed together for me. I was writing a book about the relationship between science, philosophy, and politics within Marxism, the debates within Marxism, and also the debates between Marxism and other intellectual traditions, and writing the history of these debates and exploring the current status of these debates in these different countries of Eastern Europe.
Her name is Helena Sheehan. She is professor emeritus at Dublin City University. The book she's talking about that eventually was published was Marxism and the Philosophy of Science, A Critical History, that came out in 1985. And we're talking about her new book. It's called Navigating the Zeitgeist, A Story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism. It's a memoir. It's a political and social history. It goes into a lot about what I love, which are ideas and radical ideas, her engagement with radical philosophies and theories and movements both in the U.S. and abroad. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I think it was the second time you were in the USSR. You first went, as you said, to attend the International Lenin School. Then you were invited back to continue and pursue your research. And you were studying, you were learning, you were engaging with Soviet society, and you were invited to speak and to be interviewed on Soviet media. What did you tend to speak about? And specifically, I'm wondering whether the work you were doing about debates within Marxism, within communism and communist ideas, whether you shared some of that, even though perhaps you felt that the Soviet authorities might not be enamored with that kind of expression.
Well, I met people in the Soviet Union who were the precursors of Glasnost and Perestroika, though the words weren't in circulation at this time. This was still the 1970s. But they were people that were leaning in that direction. And they brought me on to broadcast on Moscow Radio because there was a version of Marxism, and it was strong during this Brezhnev period. It's sometimes called the era of stagnation. And it was just a very stale, rote, mechanical version of Marxism that some of them, you know, didn't believe at all. You know, people join a party of power and there's an orthodoxy in the whole system and you parrot it. And, you know, there were people that were, you know, sick of it. And I was never attracted to that. And I suited their purposes because, on the one hand, you know, I was a member of a communist party, and I was quite an orthodox Marxist. On the other hand, you know, I wasn't uncritical. I believed it in a fresh, honest way, and I could articulate it in a way that was fresh and honest, and that articulated some of the problems. And they felt that, you know, that was really more in the interests of the Soviet Union than the, you know, the tired, canned kind of thing that even a lot of foreign communists parroted when they came to Moscow. And I suited their purposes. I could go a little bit further than they could because I was a foreigner. For example, I was giving a talk at the Institute of Philosophy of the USSR Academy of Sciences. And like I mentioned the names of Trotsky and Bukharin. It almost didn't matter what I said about them. But in those days, you never even mentioned their names. And there was this sort of frisson of, you know, affirmation. Because I could do things that other foreigners couldn't do because I was a communist. I could do things that other communists there couldn't do because I was a foreigner. So I began to see that I had that space and people sought me out to fill that space, and that was who I was, and so I happily filled that space.
What was Eurocommunism at the time, and why did you adopt what you call in this book a left Eurocommunist position?
Yes, it's not really the right name for it, but you have to kind of go with names, you know, as history evolves them. Eurocommunism was a movement beginning within Europe, but by no means confined to Europe, for communist parties to, you know, to think freshly what their own line was and not just take it from Moscow. So that's what Eurocommunism was. But I was a left Eurocommunist rather than a right Eurocommunist because I thought a lot of them were going too far. A lot of them actually became anti-Soviet in certain communist parties in Britain, in Spain, in Italy. They were just reacting so negatively to this Soviet-dominated, sometimes very mechanistic view of Marxism that they tended to reject too much. They rejected the whole idea of economic determinism, any kind of scientific determinism, the role of the working class, even class, they became hostile to class analysis. And I was critical of the Soviet Union, and that got me in trouble with my own party. But I didn't agree with the position of these other parties that were too negative about the Soviet Union. My attitude then and my attitude now still is that there is more to defend than to denounce about the Soviet Union and the other countries of Eastern Europe. But that didn't mean being uncritical and being and look at the problems full in the face and being completely honest about the problems. And that got me into trouble in my own party and also in certain forces in the Soviet Union.
You were against orthodoxy. You were against the suppression of dissent. You were against a one-party state. So what were you for? Were you for a political situation, a political structure in which there were multi-party elections, for example?
I wasn't immediately in the 70s against a one-party state. I, by the 80s, I was. But at that point, I wasn't arguing against the one-party state. But yes, eventually, I was. I don't think that the one-party state was defensible. I think you have to allow multi-party elections. I think you have to allow other forces to organize. And I don't think there should be such a thing as an orthodoxy in the state, in the universities. I don't think that one party should have a monopoly of power. I think that, you know, people, you have to win people's hearts and minds and get them to vote for you in honest, open, democratic elections. I came to that view, though I defended the one-party state for a while.
Your research focused on, among other things, philosophical debates that took place in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. How relatively open was the terrain of ideas and the ability to debate those ideas in the 20s as compared with the USSR under Stalin?
Well, studying the 1920s in the Soviet Union was a real revelation to me. It was against everything I'd ever been taught about the Soviet Union. The 20s were absolutely fascinating. There were debates about everything, absolutely everything, from the five-year plan to marriage to free love, everything, everything was debated. And the interesting thing was that not they were debated in the society, but they were primarily debated within the Communist Party. I found that was really fascinating.
Mm.
And so I got particularly into debates about science and philosophy, but I put them within the context of these debates about everything. Then it was quite free until the late 20s.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song, joined by Helena Sheehan, and we are talking about her new book, Navigating the Zeitgeist. I think it was the late 1970s or early 1980s, you were in Vienna, and you visited a philosopher named Wolfgang Harrick. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. And he told you that in countries, in existing socialist countries, communists were only a tiny minority of the population and could only maintain power through ruthless suppression of opposition. In fact, he defended, this man, this philosopher, defended his own imprisonment for advocating for what were considered by the regime to be dangerous ideas. What did you think of what this thinker told you?
Well, it was a series of conversations, long conversations over several days, and I found it shocking and disturbing. I'd also been talking to another Polish philosopher called Adam Schaff that was making similar arguments to me about, you know, the idea that communists couldn't hold, you know, hold power by force and had to open things up. He had a different line than Harrick, but they were kind of admitting the same problem on the ground, that communists were holding power against the will of many of the majority of the population. I didn't believe that at the time. It was very hard to know what the majority of the population thought or wanted. A lot of the population did believe in it. In different countries, the proportion was different. But certainly in the GDR and Yugoslavia, I think a lot of people did believe in it. I think that a lot of people just went along with it, the way people just go along with any system and don't question it. And I didn't, I fought against that. I didn't want to believe that. But if somebody who knew better than me was telling me that, I listened to it. I was disturbed by it. I listened to it. I weighed it. The fact that he defended his own imprisonment to me was very shocking to me. He was a very haunting person. For years, I've replayed those conversations with him over and over, and I'm glad I put them on record in this book. It was quite fascinating. But my conversations, both with Adam Schaff and Wolfgang Harrock during that week in Vienna, had a huge impact on me, made me, you know, rethink a lot of things.
Can you share with us some of the academic debates that were happening? You went to a lot of academic conferences in Eastern Europe. What were you hearing that might interest us today and that, in fact, might resonate with current debates today?
Well, as the years went on, there were debates about everything. As the 80s went on, the debates got sharper, fiercer, more and more focused. The whole debate about democracy, so the relationship between socialism and democracy, became very sharp. I was at a number of conferences in Yugoslavia, you know, and they were communists or Marxists, not all communists, they were Marxists from both East and West. And a lot of the Marxists from the East were arguing a lot with each other. And a lot of the defenders of a Marxist orthodoxy were from the West. Monthly Review, for example, the people from Monthly Review would be there, Magdoff and Sweezy, and they would be, you know, arguing a more orthodox Marxist line. And a lot of the people that were starting to hit against it were members of communist parties of Eastern Europe. That was really interesting to see that play out, particularly from 1985 on. There were so many debates about so many things. It was much more open than people realize, particularly through the 80s.
Harry Magdoff and Paul Sweezy of Monthly Review, the journal in the United States. You write near the end of your book that you found it hard to respect women who did not work, and that you argued that labor was essential to liberation. This was the early 1980s, I believe. How did you come to those conclusions, especially about women needing to work?
Yes, this is rather controversial even now. The whole wages for housework thing came up, and there's a lot of interesting social reproduction theory. I agree with social reproduction theory, but I don't think that wages for housework is the answer to that, because I think that it reinforces the traditional division of labor according to gender, and it also is part of the whole neoliberal agenda of commodifying everything. I just think that at the most basic level, I think that we live in a world where, you know, people have grown food, built houses, made clothes, created everything around us. And I don't think you can live a full and purposeful life unless you make a contribution to that, unless you give something to the world in exchange for all that you take from it. And I think that restricting female work to the family home is just not enough to live a meaningful life. I think that labor is essential to liberation, and that things will never be right for women unless the association of the female of the species with domestic labor and the male of the species with, you know, public labor is broken down. And in my lifetime, it's broken down to an extent that I would have found stunning as a child. The difference between male and female roles when I was a child and what exists now is amazing.
So in this book, you say a lot about philosophy and about philosophical trends, philosophical schools. You're very critical of a number of philosophical schools, some of which dominate the academy even today. What did you come to feel about philosophy in terms of the way in which academic philosophy was and could make a difference, could engage with social and political issues in a way that was radical and that felt comfortable for you?
Well, the potential of philosophy and the reality of philosophy departments, the gap between them grew larger and larger in my life. Philosophy as a discipline is really in trouble in contemporary universities. And I think a lot of university philosophy departments make it hard to defend. And it's part of a larger intellectual scenario. that crosses an awful lot of disciplines. And basically, the landscape, the intellectual landscape, it's a desert. What you have on the one hand, positivism on the one hand and postmodernism on the other, even though they don't even name themselves that way anymore. But they're the quanti people. It's all metrics and diagrams and reducing everything to numbers. It's a very crude form of positivism. In fact, it isn't even conscious of itself as positivism. And because original positivism had this zeal to purify knowledge and it had, you know, some big important ideas there. So it's a very crude form of positivism on the one hand. And it's not only in the sciences, but it's taken over the social sciences and the humanities more and more. On the other hand, there's all of this postmodernist waffle. And it's utterly, it's just all kinds of notions about rhizomes and assemblages and all of these concepts that are shallow and they fragment more than they synthesize. And it's all, they're both fragmentary. Both positivism and postmodernism are both fragmenting mentalities. They undermine this whole push for synthesis, which has been my driving force, and which I think is the main force that's driving the history of philosophy forward. I think the situation for philosophy and for theory generally is very bleak.
Helena Sheehan, educator, writer, veteran organizer, activist, professor emerita at Dublin City University. She has written a work of intellectual, social, and political history within the narrative frame of autobiography. It's called Navigating the Zeitgeist, a story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism. Thank you, Helena, for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And that interview first aired on July 10th, 2019. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.